When I'm working in the hospital, a lot of medical conditions can cause generalized weakness. The patient may be critically ill and deconditioned. They could be anemic, depressed, hyperglycemic, over-medicated, or they may have multi-organ dysfunction. It's rarely a true organic neurological problem when we get asked to see a patient who has newly recognized weakness. In the outpatient world, it's a whole different ballgame. When the pattern of weakness isn't focal, as in weakness that be confined to a single extremity or a lateralizing side, and therefore it's not suggestive of a single peripheral nerve, root, spinal cord, or central nervous system lesion, you have to ask yourself, does it fit a pattern that's consistent with a disorder of the muscles, a myopathy, or of the neuromuscular junction? Or could it be multiple independent peripheral nerves? In this week's episode of Brainwaves, a podcast about neurology and medicine and all the fascinating science and history that come with it, we'll review the neurologic causes of proximal patterns of muscle weakness that you'll come across, and it's important to recognize them, or at least recognize when you should consider an EMG or a muscle biopsy, because even in the hospital, when you're treating somebody who has a COPD flare and the patient's also had progressive weakness walking upstairs, you could just chalk up her ambulatory difficulty to respiratory insufficiency. But it may be something else. Maybe her hip extensors could be weak because of an inflammatory polymyositis, which can be related to lung cancer and prior tobacco use. Knowing this information could absolutely change the way you manage these patients. And more on that in a minute. I'm Jim Sigler. Don't go anywhere. For today's topic, I thought we'd discuss a case. A 28-year-old construction worker was referred to the neurology clinic by his PCP because of a persistently elevated creatinine kinase level that was initially attributed to statin use. He'd been prescribed a statin in his early 20s for a primary prevention purpose due to a family history of early heart disease and a routine cholesterol level in the 250s. Regarding the statin use, he had discontinued it more than 6 months earlier, and antibody testing against HMG-CoA reductase was negative. Still, his CK level continued to range from 3,000 to 9,000. In your clinic, the patient denied any constitutional symptoms, but he did endorse some thigh soreness that came and went regardless of the days in which he worked on construction sites. He also reported some minor difficulty while at work, and specifically, he had noticed that, compared to his coworkers, he was a little bit slower getting up the stairs, and he remembered being able to skip stairs in college, but has since been climbing up one step at a time. He said that he could still lift things normally, he felt pretty strong otherwise, it was just the stairs. But it's not really a problem, he tells you. On his physical exam, he was pretty built. 220 pounds, fair amount of muscle, no particular loss of bulk in any region. His mental status and cranial nerves were intact and normal, the power in his arms and hands were normal, but you could break his hamstrings and his quadriceps. Also, in spite of his muscular calves, he had difficulty standing on the balls of his feet, 1 foot at a time. Reflexes and sensation were normal, and movements were well coordinated. You ask him more questions about his family history, and he reports that his mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in her 40s because of some difficulties ambulating, and eventually she developed joint stiffness and contractures. She required a wheelchair within 2 years of her diagnosis. At that time, no MRIs were performed, and she was only treated with an interferon. She eventually died of a pneumonia in her 50s. The patient reports no other medication use. He smoked cigarettes in college, but not any longer, and he drinks beer on the weekends, maybe 4 or 5 beers at most in a night. No illicit substances, and no other relevant medical history or review of systems. So let's think about this case for a minute. I've already primed you to look at the case through the lens of a myopathy. So how would you characterize this pattern of muscle disease? Problems with stairs are suggestive of a proximal weakness pattern. Gluteus and biceps femoris muscles, inferior gluteal nerve, superior gluteal nerve, sciatic nerve, and L5 and S1 nerve roots. But he also has trouble standing on his toes, which involves the gastrocnemius, tibial nerve, S1 root. Hard to imagine that he could have an L5 radiculopathy without any weakness of dorsiflexion, and it might be unusual to get a bilateral S1 radiculopathy. You might explain his symptoms to a disorder of the neuromuscular junction, something like a Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, which can present with proximal lower extremity weakness, but most patients with limbs are over the age of 40 or 50, and they have an underlying cancer. A spinal cord lesion is possible, and the maternal history of multiple sclerosis is interesting, but I always force myself to doubt history of stroke or of multiple sclerosis in family members before MRIs became available. Maybe the patient's mother didn't have multiple sclerosis after all. Maybe she had something similar to what he has, and the condition could be heritable. What about a compressive cord lesion, like a canal stenosis? It's possible, but I might expect more back pain or spasticity and hyperreflexia on exam, just as I would with any other chronic central nervous system lesion. A disorder of the muscles in this case seems much more likely. When thinking about these disorders of muscle groups, if it's not a focal process, I think it's a useful exercise to characterize the prominent muscles that are affected. Is it a condition that purely affects the proximal muscles? Shoulders, biceps, triceps, hip and knee flexors and extensors. In a child, this would be a classic pattern for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And in an adult, you would consider some of the limb girdle muscular dystrophies like sarcoglycanopathy and Fukutin-related peptide muscular dystrophy. Is the pattern of weakness one that predominantly affects the proximal legs, and it either spares or involves the arm muscles? This would be consistent with some of the limb girdle myopathies like calpainopathies, or a proximal myotonic myopathy, aka myotonic dystrophy type 2. Is it a distal predominant myopathy, as you might see in dysferlinopathies, or myotonic dystrophy type 1? Does the weakness involve the proximal arms and the distal legs, kind of opposites, as you might see in fascioscapulohumeral dystrophy, FSHD? Or could it be that the distal arms and the proximal lower extremities are involved, as we see sometimes in myotonic dystrophy type 2 and some of the myofibrillary myopathies? So breaking down the pattern is important because it can be useful to narrow your differential, although it may still be inevitable that you recommend a muscle biopsy or genetic testing to confirm that suspicion you have. Anyways, getting back to our patient, the 28-year-old who we believe to have some undifferentiated myopathy. The pattern of his weakness seems to predominantly involve the lower extremities, and it seems slowly progressive. There's also evidence of chronic muscle breakdown based on the elevated CK in the serum, and maybe even a hereditary component, possibly with cardiac manifestations. But we can hardly make a diagnosis based on this information and the unclear maternal history, so we need more testing. To confirm it's a myopathy, and it's not some atypical form of a peripheral nerve disease, like a CIDP variant, and it's not some other condition like early ALS, we can get an EMG and a nerve conduction study. Now, this next tangent we're about to take is important, so listen closely. Unlike what you see on EMG in chronic motor nerve diseases, which show long-duration, high-amplitude motor unit action potentials, in a myopathy, you'll see early recruitment, short-duration, small-amplitude, polyphasic motor unit action potentials. Kind of like this. Let's break this down for a sec, because these findings are worth knowing even if you're not a neuromuscular specialist. First, the polyphasic action potentials. You see multiple motor units firing because the number of motor units, which indicate healthy firing motor nerves, does not change with loss of muscle fibers. Conversely, you might see a reduction of these motor units in a chronic neuropathy. Next, let's think about the action potential duration, the width of those waveforms that you see on the EMG. In a myopathy, the duration shortens because there's a loss of muscle fibers with each motor unit that fires. Instead of the motor nerves sprouting new branches and innervating multiple adjacent muscle fibers, as you'd see with loss of motor nerves in a neuropathy, which increases the duration of the action potential, the loss of muscle fibers in myopathies means that each motor unit involves fewer and smaller muscle fibers, creating a smaller amplitude and duration. And the recruitment pattern, which is early, or it's increased in muscle disease, means that in order for the patient to generate enough power from that muscle, there is an early and inappropriate firing of many motor units to generate a small amount of force. So to quickly recap, with loss of muscle fibers but preservation of the motor nerve, the action potentials become smaller, there's an earlier recruitment of adjacent fibers in order to generate more power, the duration of the action potentials are shorter, and there is a nonspecific polyphasia, which, to be honest, you can see in nerve diseases as well. So our patient went for the EMG, and we found that the biceps femoris, the quadriceps, and the gastroc all showed signs of a chronic myopathy, small amplitude, short duration potentials with slightly increased recruitment. But we also saw similar changes of the deltoid on the left, and the left biceps brachii. At this point, we're certain that our young gentleman has a myopathy, and largely a proximal myopathy involving predominantly the lower extremities, but also the upper extremities and the calf muscles. The differential here is very long, but if you break down the causes into major categories, you're less likely to miss something. So, in this table that I found, one of the papers you can find referenced in the show notes, the authors broke down the categories into six groups: toxic causes of proximal myopathy, drugs like statins, fibrates, corticosteroids, and other toxins like alcohol. Then there are the endocrine and metabolic myopathies, which can be caused by hypothyroidism, parathyroid disorders, adrenal pituitary dysfunction. Then there are the idiopathic inflammatory myopathies, which predominantly affect the legs in older patients, things like polymyositis and dermatomyositis with the overlap with polymyositis and inclusion body myositis. Then there's malignancy, and certain cancers can cause a paraneoplastic phenomenon with a proximal myopathy. You have the hereditary and the congenital myopathies, which include the limb girdle muscular dystrophies, FSHD, Becker's muscular dystrophy, proximal myotonic myopathy, glycogen and lipid storage disorders. The fifth category is infective myopathies, which can be related to HIV, influenza, hepatitis B and C. And then there are miscellaneous causes, things like sarcoidosis. So lots of things to think about. And for the sake of time, let's just say we excluded each of these toxic, endocrinologic, and infectious causes of myopathy. And in our patient, we referred him for a muscle biopsy to determine which kind of a heritable or congenital myopathy he might have. Now you might say, Jim, what is the point here? We know that he has myopathy. None of these heritable myopathic disorders have a known treatment. Why put the patient through the biopsy in the first place? Well, there are a couple of reasons you should refer the patient for a biopsy, and other reasons to refer for genetic counseling and to see a neuromuscular specialist at that point. First of all, there are a number of clinical trials that are underway, which are presently investigating new therapeutics, things like gene therapy and other technologies for patients with these conditions. And I just don't know all of them, so a specialist would be good here.
We've done more gene therapy trials than any place in the world in muscle disease. We've had more success.
I think research at the Johns Hopkins Myositis Center poises us in a very unique position.
We have been very involved with a number of different studies, first trying to understand the different forms of myositis.
We're currently running a phase 2 trial with...
From that, we're trying to develop new treatments.
Without that disease. These are the kinds of questions that we're trying to answer.
This type of interaction is imperative for patient care. Brings back from the lab bench directly to the clinic what we learn every day.
Second, a muscle biopsy could provide the patient with a sense of closure, an answer to that question of, what is wrong with me? Third, there is invaluable prognostic information that comes with the histopathologic diagnosis. Somebody who has adult onset Pompe's disease, as we discussed in episode 150, may have a relatively mild course of their illness, and they can be treated with enzyme replacement therapy if the diagnosis is known. Whereas somebody who has a sarcoglycanopathy may have a 40% chance of developing significant heart failure, will inevitably require positive pressure ventilation for respiratory support, and they have an average survival to about age 50 and no known treatment. Fourth, and lastly, family planning. What should the patient and their partner be thinking about? The most highly prevalent of the limb girdle muscular dystrophies, calpainopathy, is most commonly transmitted via an autosomal recessive pattern of inheritance, and it's very slowly progressive, with onset in the first or second decade of life. But in the autosomal dominant form of calpainopathy, disease onset occurs later in life. It's milder and even more slowly progressive. Honestly, I can't even keep track of all the different limb girdle muscular dystrophies, and you should refer to the published articles that we reference in this week's show notes for the summary tables classifying each type. But getting back to our patient, the 28-year-old construction worker, he goes for the muscle biopsy. The preliminary results are called back to you, and there are perivascular inflammatory cells concerning for polymyositis. But also, one of the sarcolemmal proteins of the muscle membrane, the dysferlin protein, is wholly absent. So now you're left with the question, is this an autoimmune myositis, or could this still be a heritable limb girdle myopathy? The absence of dysferlin is highly suggestive of a dysferlinopathy, but you can also see loss of this protein in other limb girdle muscular dystrophies, like a calpainopathy, again, which is the most common of the limb girdle diseases. But dysferlin should not be completely absent from the tissue on immunostaining. nor should it fail to show up on Western blot unless there is a true dysferlinopathy. Then again, there were also inflammatory cells in the perivascular space on the muscle biopsy, which could suggest a polymyositis. The serum CK is also consistent with an inflammatory myopathy, so we shouldn't just ignore this. However, polymyositis peaks in incidence in a patient's 60s, not at age 28. Even so, for this case, it would not be unreasonable to empirically treat with corticosteroids for a presumed idiopathic inflammatory myositis while you test for antibodies and for the genes that are responsible for dysferlinopathies. So you send off the ANA, the anti-Rho, anti-Law, anti-Smith, ribonucleic protein, SCL70, although the patient has no other autoimmune manifestations. You send off anti-SRP and anti-JO1, although he has no pulmonary manifestations. Maybe it is just early onset disease for polymyositis. And you send off your center's limb-girdle muscular dystrophy panel, including the genetic test for the dysferlin gene, DYSF. 2 weeks pass, and you get your answer. The gentleman has a dysferlinopathy. And his case would not be atypical for any of the dysferlinopathies, which happens to be the second most common protein deficiency among the limb-girdle myopathies. The autosomal recessive dysferlinopathy predominantly affects the lower extremities, with either proximal, distal, or both proximal and distal involvement, as in our patient. Most patients come to clinical attention in their second or third decade of life, although it can present at any age. Luckily for our patient, cardiac involvement is extremely rare, and respiratory impairment is also much less of a concern for dysferlinopathies than with other myopathies. All things considered, probably one of the milder causes of muscle weakness, and one in which he does not need to continue taking corticosteroids for. That's for certain. Historically, we had thought that there may be an inflammatory component to dysferlinopathies because the immunostaining of muscle biopsies in dysferlinopathies shows inflammatory infiltrates, but a double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover trial of the corticosteroid deflazacort was conducted in 25 patients who have this condition. Perhaps surprisingly, or maybe not unsurprisingly, the use of steroids was associated with worsening power during the study period. It was not effective. So, we still have no treatment for dysferlinopathies. For your patient, however, you are able to give him the news, counsel him on what to expect with the disease course, and reassure him that newer drugs are being explored every day. Gene therapy may be a part of his future. Presently, a phase 1 trial using an adenoviral vector is being conducted to determine whether gene transfer is safe in patients with dysferlinopathies. So, many things for him to look forward to in the future. That wraps it up for our show this week. Kind of a quick primer on proximal myopathies and a specific case of dysferlinopathy. This week's episode of Brainwaves was produced by myself, Jim Siegler. Our show is produced out of Studio 3 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with music this week that's courtesy of Jazar, Kevin McLeod, Patches, and Montplaisir under a Creative Commons license. Sound effects were by Mike Koenig and Daniel Simeon. For more information on what was discussed in the show, as always, please take a look at the show notes for the references to the highest yield literature on the topics, and follow us on Twitter at Brainwaves Audio. I'm Jim Siegler. Talk to you soon.